This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If you're looking for clues to the way life on Earth began, you have to dig deep. Now, I'm not talking about shovels and picks right now. I'm talking about studying the inner workings of the basic molecules of life, DNA and RNA.
And in fact, there's only two differences on the chemical level between RNA and DNA.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series returns to Earth with an in-depth look at these fundamental building blocks of life and, well, how little we actually know about them. We'll also spend an academic minute on another evolutionary miracle, gecko feet. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Life is widely believed to have evolved from a far simpler, self-replicating molecular structure. However, the origins of the molecular system and the life that resulted remains obscure. Enter Dr. Nicholas Hudd. Dr. Hudd is a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He is also director of the NASA Center for Chemical Evolution. He and his fellow scientists are working towards a clearer understanding of the fundamental chemical and physical principles that govern nucleic acid assembly, both RNA and DNA, and how they provide clues to the origin and early evolution of life. The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina sat down with Dr. Hudd and talked about the definition of DNA and its relationship with RNA.
Well, I'd start with DNA. It's very closely related to RNA, and I think that most everybody has heard of DNA, of course, right? It is the molecule that stores our genetic information. It's in the nucleus of the cell. It's what our chromosomes are made of, their genetic component of the chromosomes. There is a molecule that's very closely related to DNA, and that is RNA. And in fact, there's only two differences on the chemical level between RNA and DNA. In the backbone, what we call it, you know, DNA is a polymer, a very long molecule made up of units that are connected together. Part of that backbone is a sugar, and it turns out at one place on that sugar, in DNA, there's a hydrogen atom. And in RNA, there is an oxygen-hydrogen group. And that's really the biggest difference between these two molecules. It sounds pretty small, but it turns out that it allows RNA to fold up into structures that is difficult for DNA to do. On the biological level, the difference is immense with respect to what these molecules do in the cell. DNA stores the information, and pretty much only does that. When the information is going to be used by the cell, by our whole body, when we need to access that genetic information, DNA is transcribed into RNA. So this is where kind of the work starts to be done with that genetic information. RNA then serves as the template, the code to make proteins. And so that's where we're really putting that genetic information to use.
But so we're talking about information and chemicals.
Yes, chemicals. And then beyond that, what RNA is doing is the machinery in our cells that takes that information from the RNA, what we call messenger RNA, and takes amino acids and connects them together to make proteins. The machinery to do that is largely also made of RNA. So it's quite a unique molecule in our living system, that it both acts as an information carrier and as a catalyst for chemical reactions.
A term that you used here jumped out at me, which was self-assembly. So the idea that it can replicate, not only have the transference of information, but replicate or transform, if you will, and maybe you can go a little further in explaining that since I probably am missing a point here, but self-assembly, how does that happen? And, you know, how do we go back to the prebiotic soup and understand that?
Okay, so I'll back up even a little further, okay? What I say is that in the original life field for decades, there's been this kind of quandary that comes out of biology, actually, which is that, as I just mentioned, if you want to make proteins, you need to get the information from the DNA, and RNA delivers that information. But what I didn't mention is that if you want to make more DNA, or if you want to make the RNA using the DNA as a template, as the information molecule, you need proteins to help you out. And so this is where we get into kind of a chicken and the egg, because if you need the DNA and the RNA to make proteins, and you need the proteins to make the DNA and the RNA, then it begs the question, which came first, right? Because today in life, we need both of them. So as I mentioned a little earlier, something that's very unique about RNA is that it can act both as this information storage molecule and it can catalyze reactions. Well, really, those are the two biggest parts of life, say on the chemical, biological level, are information, because that's genetics, right? That's how we're able to code for the next generation, be it a human being, be it a plant, be it a bacteria. We need to code and transfer information. We also need control over chemical reactions, and that can be to make more DNA, make more RNA, but also all the parts of the cell. Those need to be reactions that we have under control. So when we look at proteins, they really can't store that chemical information, that genetic information. But here we have RNA that can do both, store information and catalyze reactions. So this has brought about a theory that's been around for decades now, that perhaps the first molecule of life was RNA, because it can do both, store information and catalyze reactions.
But so far, we can't prove it, right?
We can't prove it. And so far, what we found is that although RNA can do so many things, it can't really replicate itself. Okay, that's a tall order for anything, and especially if you're just one molecule.
Again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but are we looking for an independent variable or something else here that's triggering this on the outside?
That's a great question, because that actually does get into my work. There have been theories that RNA can spontaneously form, but it needs some help. Chemically, it's pretty difficult to do. As you know, here at RPI, there's been lots of beautiful research done looking at the possibility that minerals, particularly and clay mineral surfaces, could have helped RNA get assembled. In my lab, we're looking at some different ideas. We have a term we like to call the molecular midwife, and that's more of a concept. And our idea is that within the pool of molecules that would make up RNA, perhaps there were other molecules present that could have helped RNA assemble. Okay, and so we have some ideas, and that's where we get to the self-assembly, because we know that certain molecules, say in aqueous solution, they tend to stack. These tend to be planar molecules. You can think of them as looking like, say, even kitchen plates that are stacking on top of each other. And they tend to do that in aqueous solution. And the bigger they are, the better they stack. And so one of our ideas is that maybe there was a molecule a little bit bigger than the bases. And the bases I'm talking about are in RNA and DNA. Remember, G pairs with C and A pairs with T. Well, if you think about a molecule that's about the size of those bases already paired together, then such molecules could have helped assemble those first parts of the RNA. So that's one of the theories we're working on right now.
Here's a naive question, but it's come up in past interviews with the question of the origins of life. We now see places like Lake Vostok and other places that they've gone to the depths of the ocean to find new species of life. Is it possible some of those original molecules could be trapped in some spot on the Earth where we could find them?
Let me say that some of those original molecules are trapped inside of us. Okay.
Okay.
This is something that I think we really can't overstate, is that we, as biological organisms, we are the best clues to where we came from. When you talk about could some of these molecules still be in existence, the lifetime of these molecules is not long enough that they would be still there from when life started, probably about 3.5 to 4 billion years ago. None of them would have survived that long. But because the evolution of biological organisms over time has not likely erased all of, say, the signs of where we came from, we have clues. And one of them is the structure of RNA. Now, we don't know that RNA, as it is today, its chemical structure, is exactly the same as it was, say, at the beginning of life, but probably was of a similar type of molecule. And that's also what my laboratory and other laboratories are investigating, is what molecule might have existed that could function like RNA that if we, as chemists, saw it today, we would recognize it as being very RNA-like, but perhaps could have self-assembled much more easily than RNA.
What are your investigations revealing?
Well, what we are finding is that these molecules that we call midwives can be very powerful in driving the assembly of RNA, or very short pieces of RNA. In a series of experiments that we published just about a year ago, we showed that if you're trying to take very small pieces of RNA, let's say 4 bases in length, so just 4 units stitched together, and you want to take these and stitch them into long polymers, something that would be, say, gene length. You would like to have them hundreds in length, if not thousands. We find that if we put in these molecules, again, these molecules we call midwives, we find that the concentration needed to have them self-assemble in solution drops down by about a factor of 1,000 to 10,000. And so a help of a little molecule goes a long way in these experiments.
What's the significance of that?
The significance is that it relaxes the constraints, you might say, the obstacles that need to be overcome in a prebiotic scenario, we would call it. So if we did not have these molecules, then we would have to have the concentration of these bases of RNA be 1,000 to 10,000 times higher than it would be without them. And, you know, making these molecules, we can do it under plausible prebiotic reactions, but making them at high concentrations is always going to be a problem. So if we can reduce the concentration that is needed for them to assemble into RNA, that's all the better.
And I imagine you can't completely mimic at all the outside conditions that existed in this prebiotic soup as temperatures rose and fell and all sorts of things caused the chemical makeups to change dramatically.
Right. We don't know exactly what the conditions were like on the early Earth. And I think that that's one of our jobs as chemists that are trying to synthesize these molecules. In a way, I think our work, it goes hand in hand with what the geologists do. The geologists have rocks that have existed from back at those times, and they can pull out information about what the Earth was like. But I also think from the chemistry side, if we can crack this problem of how the first RNA-like molecules came about, that can give us clues about what the environment was like. And something that you said there really touches on our work as well. You talked about kind of cycles happening. And you know, when we think about the polymers of life, that there must have been some process that helped them stitch together. Well, I think cycles on the Earth, such as rain and drying when the sun comes up, those are wonderful cycles that could have driven the chemical reactions that we need to make these polymers.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Nicholas Hudd continues with a look at the future of his research. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1154. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Hudd, a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He is also director of the NASA Center for Chemical Evolution. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, about his research on the evolution of DNA and RNA as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life.
So let's look forward for a second, because if there's been an evolution in these molecules, where are we going?
Well, I think that we ourselves, you know, we as in living organisms, definitely we're always evolving, right? That's never going to stop. But the materials that we are made out of, we may have reached a point where those basic materials are not going to change. RNA has probably been with us for about 3.5 billion years. What I will say is that we can look at the molecules we have today and say there's still some signs of how they evolved. And an example is DNA. I look at DNA now, and I think that that was the next stage of evolution, such as RNA evolved DNA. Because, you know, DNA is wonderful in its job as this genetic storage material, and it's much more stable than RNA. RNA, you know, if you have it in the test tube in the laboratory, depending upon the conditions, you know, by the end of the day, it can be broken up into parts. It's not a stable molecule. Whereas DNA, as you know, we can extract it out of dinosaur bones, right? It's a very stable molecule. And so I think that there was a time, again, billions of years ago, where the materials of life were still changing. Those basic building blocks that were being used, they were evolving. But I think at one point, life came upon a really wonderful set of materials to work with. And now, for better or for worse, we're kind of, I hate to say stuck with that set, or I should say, it's so good now, there's no reason to change.
And of course, scientists like yourself are getting better and better and better at understanding the DNA and the RNA and the processes there within. And, you know, I'm wondering, as we look at this process and you're picking apart these molecules and we're looking at theories for the origins of life, what about practical applications?
Oh, well, part of the work that we're doing, I would say that a practical application is that we're trying to come up with methods by which we can self-assemble RNA-like molecules. If we are successful in doing that, we could have a chemical pathway for making very interesting medically relevant polymers that would be difficult to make by other means, by, say, traditional organic synthesis or by the use of natural enzymes that may not tolerate the type of polymers that we want to make. So that's I think, could be one of the big impact is making materials and bioactive polymers that, again, mimic the ones that are in life but are different and, say, have certain advantages, maybe from a materials aspect or a medicinal aspect.
Can you go a little further with that and give us an example? What would be a material aspect or a medicinal aspect in the use of these polymers?
Well, for instance, we know now that RNA molecules, there's processes that are called in vitro selection that can be used to discover RNA sequences, RNA molecules that fold up and recognize, bind to specifically, say, proteins or other molecules that are in living organisms. And these are now being explored and used as therapeutic agents. So those are very valuable. But as I mentioned just a minute ago, RNA is not that stable. And in fact, when RNA gets into a cell that's coming from the outside, the cell wants to chew it up because it can look like an infection from the outside. But imagine that we could make a molecule that functions like RNA, but is not natural, then it might actually have then a longer lifetime, so to speak, within our cells. So we might be able to expand, say, our toolkit of molecules that we can use to do this evolution in a test tube.
So perhaps fighting disease of some kind.
Yeah, fighting disease. And then also I'd say that if we look at all the materials, the wonderful materials of life, right? Life is absolutely the best chemist on earth. But if we could then come up with some different materials to work with, you know, for instance, nucleic acids, which are RNA and DNA, they're negatively charged. Each unit has a negative charge on its backbone. Well, what if we could come up with some molecules that can also evolve, also act like RNA and DNA, but maybe have positive charges on their backbone? Now, this is not something that life would ever, say, evolve and use in its cell nowadays. But if we could come up with the principles for self-assembly, for replication of RNA-like molecules, and be able to do it with positively charged molecules, well, then these molecules would have very different properties, right? And then we could use them. We could use them, again, for medicinal reasons, or we could use them in making materials as part of material science work.
Well, before we end, I just want to ask a question I ask all the scientists as we look forward with the exponential explosion of technology that we've seen in our lifetimes. Are you hopeful that some of these things you're talking about happening will happen?
I think they will. I'm always, as I like to think, the perennial optimist. And I think the next discovery is coming. But, you know, as we look back over the last few years, it's amazing the advances that have come in this field, the amount we understand now about molecules that were around at the time of the original life, going from what we call the top-down approach, looking at life today and trying to understand through the analysis of genome sequences, we are now understanding so much about what we would call our last universal common ancestor, an organism that is in common in the lineage of bacteria and ourselves, you know, so far back. Such studies like that make me quite hopeful that within my scientific lifetime, put it that way, that our top-down approach will take us back so far in evolution that we will join up with what we would call our bottom-up approach, where we're trying to synthesize these molecules like RNA in a prebiotic environment.
Dr. Nicholas Hudd is a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He is also director of the NASA Center for Chemical Evolution. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. You can learn more about all the topics in our astrobiology series at origins.rpi.edu. Studying evolution isn't just molecules and theories. Sometimes it's as simple as looking at a lizard. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Because the gecko's climbing ability is unmatched by anything in the natural world, scientists have been working hard to replicate its gripping skills. And as Tony Gamble, postdoctoral researcher at the University of Minnesota, explains, species in the gecko family have evolved this remarkable feature multiple times.
The climbing abilities of geckos have fascinated people for centuries. Geckos are a type of lizard and consist of over 1,400 species, about 60% of which have adhesive or sticky toe pads. Adhesive toe pads allow geckos to run across smooth, vertical, or even inverted surfaces like ceilings with incredible speed. Recently, scientists have discovered the molecular mechanisms that allow geckos to stick. Hundreds of thousands of microscopic hair-like bristles cover the underside of each toe, each of which can potentially adhere to a surface using weak intermolecular forces. The combination of all these bristles working together generates enough adhesive force to support the whole animal. Knowing how geckos stick is just part of the story, though. How do these complex adhesive toe pads evolve? Scientists have long thought that sticky toes originated just once, or at most twice, in geckos. An alternative hypothesis is that sticky toe pads evolved again and again in different gecko species, a process called repeated or convergent evolution. To answer this question, my colleagues and I first needed to understand how different gecko species are related to each other. We used DNA sequences from hundreds of gecko species to make a gecko family tree. We reconstructed the evolutionary history of adhesive toe pads by tracing or mapping the occurrence of sticky toes onto this tree. We were amazed to discover that adhesive toe pads were gained 11 times. And just as extraordinary, once gained, adhesive toe pads were subsequently lost in 9 different gecko groups. Gecko toe pads, therefore, represent an example of repeated evolution. Biologists are particularly interested in this phenomenon because the independent gains and losses of sticky toes and geckos can be thought of as natural experiments conducted over deep evolutionary time. By studying these replicated patterns, we can gain a better understanding not only of gecko biology, but of the fundamental processes that drive evolution.
That was Tony Gamble of the University of Minnesota. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions. which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.